Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Sacklers, a family worth billions, a name emblazoned on art museums and university chairs and educational endowments. What the family name, what the family and name have not been widely linked to is America's devastating opioid epidemic, an epidemic that many trace right back to OxyContin, the source of the Sacklers' vast wealth. Their privately held company brought the painkiller to market, sold it hard, downplayed addiction, made a fortune. This hour On Point, the billionaire family in the roots of our opioid epidemic. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How should we look at this fortune? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is writer and editor Christopher Glazek. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, GQ, The New York Times Magazine, Vice, many other magazines. His October 16th piece in Esquire is headlined, "The Secretive Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Christopher Glazek, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
How wealthy is this family?
Well, the latest estimates from Forbes are $13 billion. Forbes said that that's a conservative estimate, though. We don't know for sure unless the family tells us exactly what their net worth is.
They're very well known for philanthropy. You can find their name all over the place, the Sackler name. We'll look at where the money came from, but there are sort of philanthropic crown jewels here. Give us a sense of how widely the Sackler name is emblazoned on philanthropic fruits.
The Sacklers are really among the very most significant philanthropists in the world. There are Sackler wings at the Met in New York, at the Louvre in Paris, at the Royal Academy in London. There are named Sackler institutes or galleries at virtually every Ivy League school. Basically, anywhere in the arts and higher education, if it's the best, you'll see Sackler somewhere in the mix.
Go on. Name some more. It's interesting.
So, there's Sackler Institutes at Yale, at Columbia, at NYU, at Tufts, at Sussex, at King's College London. There are Sackler Museums at Harvard. Sacklers have given large grants to scientists at Caltech, at MIT. The list really goes on and on and on.
Beijing University and galleries all over the place, at the Smithsonian, at Oxford, the Guggenheim in New York, you report, has a Sackler Center. The American Museum of Natural History has a Sackler Educational Lab. The Sackler Staircase is there in Berlin's Jewish Museum. The Sackler Escalator at the Tate Modern. The Sackler
That's right.
Crossing in Kew Gardens. It's like you can't go anywhere without finding it.
They are notorious for their pursuit of naming rights.
And also naming and financing academic pursuits. The Sackler Institute for Nutrition Science, the Sackler Institutes at Cornell, Columbia, McGill, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Sussex, King's College, all over the place.
That's right. It's interesting. It's a different philanthropic approach than we're used to from someone like Bill Gates, who kind of had his own giant foundation that kind of undertook his own initiatives. Or if you think of somebody from the Gilded Age like Andrew Carnegie, who founded thousands of local libraries. What the Sacklers have done is they've braided the family name through the patronage networks of the most elite institutions in the world. So you could kind of say that they've bought into blue chip brands.
So – all right. Let's hold that thought. It is not hard to find the evidence of their philanthropy. And take us back, if you would, to the very beginning of this story, how this fortune was built. Who are the Sacklers?
So the Sacklers are three brothers from Brooklyn who were born in the 19-teens and come from a family of Jewish immigrants. And they each became psychiatrists. The eldest brother, Arthur Sackler, who is really the patriarch of the family, he really made his name, or I should say made his fortune, in pharmaceutical advertising. And he was a huge innovator in this field. When he started working in pharmaceutical advertising in the 40s, you know, it wasn't the way it is today. Basically, what we had were door-to-door salesmen. They were called detail men. And they mm-hmm. would kind of push their drugs on doctors in a kind of, you know, one-on-one way. Arthur's great insight was that you could use print advertising in medical journals to reach a much larger number of doctors.
And he did that for what famous drug?
So, I mean, most famously, he created the marketing strategy for Valium. And he helped turn Valium into the most widely prescribed drug in the United States, the first drug ever to reach $100 million in sales.
How did he do that? What was the approach of Arthur Sackler with Valium and marketing Valium?
Well, it was very interesting because there was another drug already on the market by the same manufacturer called Librium. And Librium and Valium are basically the same. They're both benzos. Librium had been marketed narrowly for anti-anxiety purposes. And anxiety at that time wasn't quite the buzzword that it is today. Mm-hmm. Arthur's idea was to take this already kind of existing substance, but, you know, with the new name, Valium, and then market it for a huge range of ailments and indications. And, you know, his approach basically was saying that, look, we're going to create this new kind of condition called psychic tension, which is kind of what we might think of as stress today, mm-hmm. and link it to all of these somatic conditions, headaches, digestion problems, sleep problems, sexual problems, you know, whatever might be ailing you, maybe its cause, he suggested, is psychic tension. And in that way, he was able to target it at a vast universe of patients.
This was hugely successful. Arthur Sackler became, you report, one of the first inductees into the Medical Advertising Hall of Fame. And I guess a template was kind of laid down here as well. We'll come to that. He made a lot of money, the Sackler family, Arthur Sackler in particular, out of that. What kind of money? I mean, it wasn't anything like OxyContin money, but it was big.
Right. No, I mean, it was, you know, hundreds of millions, most likely. He was compensated in terms of volume of pills sold because, you know, he was the ad man. He wasn't actually wow. in-house at the manufacturer.
But that's interesting for the template as well. Compensated
yes.
for volume of pills sold.
That's right. And it is a volume-driven model. The model was how can we pump as much of this addictive drug into the country as possible?
Wait, was Valium addictive?
Oh, yes. Valium was incredibly addictive and, you know, and at the time was its own kind of addiction crisis and spawned all kinds of investigations and worries. You know, it did not have the same deadly impact that OxyContin and other opioids have had. But benzos are responsible for a lot of deaths also.
A big fortune built there. It turned out to be kind of a trial run. What did the Sacklers do with that early money? Where did it show up in the philanthropic world?
So Arthur began art collecting in the 1950s, and he had actually taken art classes at Cooper Union as a student alongside medical school. When he started collecting art, he went for something that he thought was a big opportunity that was kind of underexposed in the art market, and that was ancient Chinese artifacts. And he said, oh, look, so this is this whole universe that's kind of – that people don't really know that much about, and I can acquire lots of work very cheaply – and have a big impact on this field. And that's exactly what he did. He actually assembled the largest collection in the world of ancient Chinese artifacts. And he used that to stage exhibitions at museums and acquired a lot of kind of acclaim that he never was able to get from his business endeavors because his business endeavors were always quite secret. With the art, you know, his second wife published – he had three wives. His second wife published a memoir, kind of self-published, only a couple hundred copies. And she basically blames the dissolution of their marriage on his maniacal art collecting, which she specifically compared to a drug addiction.
1974, Arthur and his brothers Mortimer and
– Raymond.
Raymond, right. They gave a large gift to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, large for that time, $3.5 million, to erect what most anyone who's been to the Met will have seen, the Egyptian, the Temple of Dendur there. Tell us about that.
That's right. So Arthur Sackler, well known in museum circles. Everyone was always trying to bag him as a donor. People knew that Arthur Sackler was interested in Middle East peace. And the Temple of Dendur was actually a gift from the Egyptian government. And the director at the Met at the time was able to convince Arthur to undertake this endowment. But Arthur imposed very onerous terms on the Met. He had done this through a number of donations over the years. But he mandated, for instance, that every reference to any item shown in the Sackler wing had to include all three brothers' names with MD at the end.
And then we come to the – so there's the Valium Fortune era, and now we begin to come to the OxyContin era. But the origins of that are very interesting. Take us from the get-go there.
Right. So Arthur had all kinds of secret companies. His kind of was best known as an ad man, but he also purchased a small pharmaceutical company in 1952, which was called Purdue Frederick. Purdue Frederick had been a kind of patent medicine peddler. Sold this drink for decades, from the 19th century called Gray's Glycerin Tonic, which was also, kind of marketed for any purpose.
A lot of sherry in there, I think.
A lot of sherry, right. That was really the active ingredient. So when the brothers purchased Purdue in 1952, Arthur bought it, had his brothers run it. He concealed his own stake in it because you couldn't be an ad man and also a manufacturer. Okay. That would have been a conflict of interest. Mm-hmm. But so he had his brothers run the company. For years and years, it was really a kind of a midget, in the industry. It didn't have any super successful products. Its first big break came in the 1960s when it acquired the rights to Betadine, which is an antiseptic. And they had the good fortune of the Vietnam War going on.
A lot of soldiers treated with that to keep them from getting infected in Vietnam.
Exactly. So, but the real money didn't come until they got into the pain business. And that started kind of in the 1970s, the company lore, and it's hard to know what's exactly true, but basically it was a hospice doctor in London, where the hospice movement was actually born, went to their company and said, hey, I see you've got this time-released asthma medication that no one's really buying. What if you created a time-released morphine pill? And that would be great for the people in the hospice because if they had a time-released pill, they could sleep through the night and wouldn't need an IV. The company took this advice and they created a time-release morphine medication that came out in the early 1980s called MS-Contin. It's really OxyContin's uncle, you could say.
And, of course, that was, though, for cancer patients who were dying. If they became addicted, it wouldn't matter.
Exactly.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the family that has made billions off America's opioid flood, the family that sold us on OxyContin and downplayed the risks. Now we look around and see what's happening on the opioid front. It's not all pharmaceuticals anymore. That's kind of peaked out. But the origins of this, absolutely fascinating. Christopher Glazek has written it up for Esquire magazine. The Secret of Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis is his headline. Joins us today from New York, and you can join us as well. Can you imagine how much money the painkiller tsunami meant for one family? And how do the drug fortune and the nation's struggle with opioids now sit next to the Sackler gusher of philanthropy, the art museums, the university chairs. Christopher Glazek, you had us in the, during the Vietnam War period, this time-release morphine drug developed in the UK. And you write in your piece that the U.S. had been very resistant to bringing opioids in. There was a kind of opiophobia owing in part to a heroin epidemic that had been fueled by returning Vietnam veterans. Doctors were skittish about going there. How did the Sacklers and Purdue play into that difficult environment?
Well, that's right. So, yeah, in the 1970s, there was a vicious heroin epidemic in the United States. And, you know, these things have kind of gone through cycles throughout history. You know, morphine has been around for centuries, obviously caused the opium wars in China.
Yeah.
So you kind of see a back and forth that, you know, when societies have a lot of problems with opioid and rampant addiction, then they start to pull back and then they forget about it and then they start to liberalize opioid regimes again. So, you know, the Sacklers had a kind of challenging context, but they were able to take advantage of the growing hospice movement and the growing palliative care movement, which, you know, honestly also had something to do with the war wounded. Mm-hmm. And when they released their time-release morphine pill, narrowly targeted for the cancer market, it made their company much more prestigious and it made their company have this kind of sheen of moral superiority because they were helping the dying live out their last days with some peace.
And this was still they labeled it MS Contin. Contin as in what, like continuous release or something? Was that the idea of
exactly.
the Contin?
Yes. Contin stands for continuous. That's
okay.
right.
Okay. And that was the morphine-based that had been introduced in the UK. They brought it here. But still, American doctors were very skittish about opioids. And one would have thought that, you know, moving anywhere beyond the hospice movement would have been really tough. How did they get past that?
Right. So a couple things happened that were fortuitous for the Sacklers. You know, as their cancer drug, MS Contin, became more and more clinicians kind of, you know, semi-organically started saying, hey, why don't we start using this for other conditions too, not just for cancer pain, but for other kinds of chronic pain. And there were a couple of very fateful studies written in the 1980s that kind of suggested using, you know, faulty data that the risk of addiction was actually quite small for people taking powerful opioids.
Now, this is a big deal because this is what the skittishness was all about. Doctors didn't want to get their patients addicted.
Right. So there, you know, there were some currents in the medical community that wanted to, you know, to reform opiophobia and wanted to get doctors to be more comfortable prescribing these drugs. They started to form groups, kind of lobbying pressure groups. They had names like the American Academy of Pain Medicine or the American Pain Society. And then the Sacklers company, Purdue, lavishly funded these groups. Other pharmaceutical companies also got in the game. And so you started to have this kind of broad-based movement that, you know, had some grassroots elements, but it was also kind of astroturfed, right? I mean, it had this mm-hmm. huge influx of money from the pharmaceutical interests who had a big interest in eliminating this stigma against opioids.
Can we stick with that 80s research for a minute? Because this was critical to the acceptance of the Contins. This, what it was, a letter to the editor published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1980 suggesting, and I'm quoting you here, based on a highly unrepresentative cohort, that the risk of addiction from long-term opioid use was less than 1%. And you write, though ultimately disavowed by its author, the letter ended up getting cited in medical journals more than 600 times. That's a lot of amplification.
That's true. That's right. You know, and the letter kind of got dredged up several years later. It didn't make a huge splash when it first came out. But, it, you know, Purdue Pharma, the manufacturer of OxyContin, kind of had this holy trinity of studies that they would circulate that purported to show that the risk of addiction was very, very small. Of course, there were other studies, including studies that the company had funded but never published, that suggested much higher rates of addiction.
And now we come to
perhaps 13%.
Yeah. Now we come to a next generation of the Sackler family. This is Raymond's eldest son, Richard Sackler, who was right at the center of the Purdue's work, the pharmaceutical company. And you say at all the meetings, there was a constant source of discussion, what else can we use the Contin system for? They were concerned that they didn't want to build it around the MS Contin because morphine had a stigma. People hear that word, you report and say, wait a minute, I'm not dying or anything. Why would I take morphine? So what was the answer?
That's exactly right. You know, ordinary doctors were not comfortable prescribing morphine. That sounded like some really serious stuff, like you were on your last legs. You know, only kind of, you know, specialists would be prescribing morphine. The idea was, well, what if we took this other opioid, also comes from the poppy, opium poppy plant, oxycodone, which had been around for years and years. It was kind of a dusty old chemical. But it had a very different brand identity than morphine. Ordinary doctors were comfortable with oxycodone because it was the active ingredient in Percocet and Percodan. These are weak combination opioids, and they have some acetaminophen in them or some aspirin, and then a very little bit of opioid. And you know, Percocet is prescribed all the time for minor injuries and things like that. So you know, doctors had this sense that oxycodone was something much weaker than morphine. Actually, it's stronger than morphine on a milligram per milligram basis. And so former employees of the company also told me, you know, we had this other advantage, which is that a lot of people mispronounced oxycodone and they called it oxycodine.
Sounded like cough syrup. Big deal.
Sounded like cough syrup. Sounded like codeine, another very weak opioid. And the company, you know, in internal marketing documents that I looked at, they said, okay, we're going to exploit this misconception. They acknowledged doing that in a court settlement later. We're not going to do anything to make doctors think that oxycodone is actually stronger than morphine.
So we get OxyContin, and you remind us that OxyContin sales started out pretty small in 1996. You say in part because Purdue first focused, as you say, on the cancer market to get acceptance from HMOs and state Medicaid programs. And then describe the arc of the sales of OxyContin and how big it became and how.
Exactly. So they start with a cancer market, which they had done before. It kind of looks like a Trojan horse in retrospect. And after they got formulary acceptance from insurance companies and Medicaid programs, then they started really pounding the pavements and hitting the phones. And then they started targeting this drug to 30 million back pain patients or rather doctors who treated back pain patients. They targeted it at OBGYNs saying that that they should prescribe it for menstrual pain, for headaches, to dentists that they targeted this drug, saying that for certain kinds of toothaches that this strong, long-acting opioid might be an appropriate treatment. And so, you know, it was a couple years later that their marketing team really amped up. They tripled their sales force. They were actually employed just as many sales reps as the DEA did drug diversion agents who were, you know, employed to try to prevent drugs from spreading. And the sales reps had a variety of tools in their toolbox to try to get doctors to prescribe the drug. They would fly them on expensive vacations to places like Pebble Beach. They would send them all kinds of swag. They would sign them up automatically to join their speakers bureau. So I was actually told by a former employee, if a doctor was really resisting and said, I don't know about these strong opioids, this seems like a little overkill, these were called problem doctors at the company. And they said, okay, well, with these people, what we can do is say, hey, we really respect your work. We know that you're respected in your local community. You know, this could be like in, you know, Memphis, Tennessee or something. We want to make you a speaker and we want you to come to a dinner and give a little 10-minute presentation about your practice. And we'll give you, you know, $500 or maybe $1,000 for your trouble.
And the problem was solved with the problem doctor.
The problem was solved, yes.
So yeah, so on the back of all this, between 96 and 2001, OxyContin prescriptions in the United States just soared. They went from 300,000 to nearly 6 million. Reports of abuse starting to bubble up, you report, in West Virginia, Florida, Maine. The sales by 6 million had surged past $1 billion annually of OxyContin. Now, people are in all kinds of businesses, and, you know, Americans are pretty okay with that. I guess the critical point here is, and here there was pain, there was suffering, and this was addressing that, and that was not a small thing. Now, when we look at the opioid crisis out there, it's the addiction piece that sticks. And I guess the point, when you look at the Sackler fortune, the point at which you really want to be most keenly focused is what they knew and how they thought about the addictive properties here and how those were presented in this enormous sales push. Help us understand, Christopher.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the reasons I was attracted to this story is I wanted to figure out, you know, who's really responsible for the opioid epidemic, who benefited most, who had the most aerial view of what was unfolding. And it was not the government, and it was not individual doctors, and it wasn't pharmacists, and frankly, it was not the distributors either. It was the manufacturers. They are the ones that had the most detailed data down to the prescription level. So they knew which doctors were prescribing how much, and you know, in whatever, you know, whatever small town, they had a list they actually kept of doctors who were suspected of running pill mills, and they did not share that list with law enforcement for many years. you know, ironically, so they had this data because they subscribed to IMS, which is this big kind of data prescription data mining company. Arthur Sackler had actually secretly founded that years and years ago, although the family later divested their interest of it.
Did they misrepresent the addiction risk?
Yes. So they instructed sales reps, the company instructed sales reps to claim that OxyContin was less addictive than other opioids on the market. Now, the FDA had allowed them to kind of make this astonishing labeling claim that did not go quite that far. The FDA did not allow them to say that OxyContin was less addictive than other drugs. But it did say, you know, this is a time-release medication, and we think it might be possible that time-release drugs have less addictive potential. And the thought was that, hey, if you're an addict, you want that narcotic payload immediately. You don't want to wait around for 12 hours to have it slowly see through your system. That was nonsense, though. You know, as had been known for a long time, time-release mechanisms were easily circumvented by addicts. And in the case of OxyContin, you could just kind of suck off the outer shell or dissolve it in water. You could inject it. You could crush it and snort it. It was kind of elementary for addicts to get around the time-release mechanism and to get the full payload all at once. It's worth pointing out, I don't think I mentioned this in the piece, but MS-Cotton, their drug from the 80s for cancer patients, the predecessor, that had commanded the highest street value and was always very prized among addicts because it had so much pure narcotic in a single pill.
You're right, sales reps were encouraged to downplay addiction risks. And then you're quoting here Shelby Sherman. This was a longtime sales rep for Purdue, the Sackler company, from 1974 to 1998, saying it was sell, 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 he recalled. We were directed to lie. Why mince words about it? Greed took hold and overruled everything. They saw that potential for billions of dollars and just went after it. Christopher Glazik writes it up for Esquire. He's with us. How long did it take for people to become concerned about this?
Well, it was actually relatively quickly after Purdue started marketing OxyContin more broadly, and the prescription started surging. So, for instance, Richard Blumenthal, who's now a senator from Connecticut, he had been the attorney general of Connecticut, mm-hmm. and he had met with Richard Sackler in 2001 and wrote him this very strongly worded letter, saying, hey, you guys got to clean up your act. You're pumping this market full of opioids. And, the kind of concessions that you're trying to make in return, Purdue said, oh, God, we're so concerned about addiction, actually, and we're going to – well, actually, they didn't say addiction. They hated that word. Mm-hmm. They called addiction pseudo-addiction. Mm-hmm. But they did believe it – but they did say that they were against the black market. So they took a number of kind of cosmetic steps to try to prevent drugs from getting in the wrong hands. They distributed tamper-resistant prescription pads on all their pills destined for Mexico. They stamped an M so that DEA agents would know that they'd come from the wrong market. All these steps actually also had the effect of kind of protecting their sales. They didn't want Mexican pills seeping over the border, which could which were sold at a lower price. But what they didn't do is they didn't change their volume-driven business model. And at the end of the day, the opioid crisis is about the volume of pills seeping through the market.
Blumenthal wrote to them as Attorney General in Connecticut, it's time for Purdue Pharma to change its practices. This was to Richard Sackler, he wrote, not just its public relations strategy, but were there legal consequences?
Well, absolutely, yeah. So there were dozens of lawsuits filed against Purdue in the early 2000s. And for a long time, Purdue had tremendous success swatting them away, particularly when they were brought by patients, like kind of class action from patients. Opioid addicts do not always make for very sympathetic clients. And they had a lot of trouble convincing judges to let these cases proceed. Also, the FDA had approved the drug, which was a powerful defense. Mm-hmm. What was ultimately determined, though, is that Purdue went far beyond what the FDA allowed in the claims that it made about the drug. And that's kind of ultimately what made them take the fall. But they said that they never lost a lawsuit. They actually settled some lawsuits for huge amounts. And in particular, what I found in my reporting, talking to plaintiffs' lawyers, if the lawyers ever named family members in the suit – then the checkbook came out pretty soon. They did not want family members deposed. They did not want them named. Mm. And that was
even though Richard was CEO.
Richard was president of the company. He was president, really the top executive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, technically, Raymond was still CEO, but he was a very old man. Richard was really running the show. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, there was this giant federal settlement that the government negotiated with Purdue, in which the company pled guilty to criminal charges, to felony charges, actually. And its three top executives at the time, in 2007, had to plead guilty to misdemeanor charges. So in 2007, you know, and the charge was a criminal misbranding of a drug. At the time of that settlement, it was the CEO, the chief medical officer, and the general counsel who went down. So the media kind of covered it as if, like, hey, like, all the big guys went down. Mm-hmm. You know, justice has been served here. But at the during the period that the settlement was looking at, when OxyContin was developed and promoted and came out, the CEO, the top executive, was a Sackler family member. So that kind of got written out of the story.
The executives paid $34.5 million out of their pockets, performed 400 hours of community service. But here we are in 2017, and we've got a country in full opioid crisis. The president expected to speak about that in this week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the family that's made billions off America's opioid flood, the family that sold the country on OxyContin and downplayed the risks while America got hooked. Now here we are. Christopher Glazek has written up the story of the Sackler family for Esquire magazine. The Secret of Family Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis is his headline. He's with us today from New York. We're going to hear in a few minutes from Mike Moore, the guy who led the big national litigation against tobacco companies, who is now looking at the pharmaceutical industry and the opioid crisis. Paul in Atlanta, Georgia, you're listening to this story. What do you hear? Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Yeah, I'd like to make a comment about this family and them making billions. Should they be held accountable to open up recovery clinics? I think that they, you know, it's a duty, since they've made so much money, that they open up recovery clinics for this opioid crisis that's going on.
Do you have experience with the crisis, Paul?
Yes, I do. Personally, I've lost two friends this year to the opioid crisis, and it's been a very tough year. Considering that they, you know, were the best of people, good people, and these drugs are made available because they're quote unquote legal, and they can get them from doctors or wherever.
Yep, yep.
And then next thing you know, they're gone.
Paul, I appreciate your call, and we'll pick up your question about recovery clinics. Matthew in Rochester, New York. Matthew, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. What's your story?
I just wanted to share that when I was a teenager, I became addicted to OxyContin, and that led to a heroin addiction. And it was many years of difficult situation and hard times. And I didn't know when I was taking the OxyContin what a powerful drug it was. Mm. And I just wanted to share that kids, I don't think, understand when they take it, that it's a very powerful substance.
Are you clean now, Matthew? Clean and sober?
Yes, 8 years.
Congratulations, man. Stick with it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Doug in Kittery, Maine. Doug, you're on.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. I've been following this case for a while and writing my representatives, trying to get some action. And following up on the earlier caller, I think the Sackler family in Purdue should be on the hook for funding clinics in every community in every state that's getting ravaged. My son plays baseball. He's in middle school. He had an uncle that, you know, he showed up to games early in the season, then all of a sudden he was gone. It's criminal the way they corrupted the system and abused it. And, you know, now they're trying to buy themselves respectability, making these grand donations to art museums and Harvard naturally. I think they ought to step up to the table, put their name all over it. The Sackler Recovery Center in every state, funded by the Sackler family.
Doug, I appreciate your call. Christopher Glazek, what about accountability? The Sacklers, you say, haven't been actively involved in managing since 2003, an executive position at Purdue. OxyContin market, you know, I mean, the opioid crisis has sort of gone elsewhere. It topped out, fell by a third between 2012 and 2016. But here we are in a crisis. What would accountability mean here? And what do you take from this story?
Well, the callers make excellent points, and I just want to say I investigated the family for 5 months and was able to find no evidence that they ever gave a single dime to any addiction clinic or addiction research. You know, they've spread their philanthropy around widely. One of the things they have not supported is addiction research, and I asked them, and they were unable to come up with an example. So you know, we have an opioid crisis, and we also have an accountability crisis, and we tend to think about public health problems as a result of these large impersonal forces, and that can be true, but can also destroy from the fact that many social problems are ultimately the result of actions taken by individuals. And that's one of the things I wanted to highlight in the piece.
But are we past the point of accountability for the Sacklers and their, would you say, $13-14 billion?
That's right. That's right. You know, so I mean, the legal risks that the Sacklers potentially face, is a complex question. It seems unlikely that the family fortune is in any serious peril. Purdue, though, the company has every day a fresh lawsuit is filed against it, and they are very likely to incur very serious legal consequences. You know, the question also has to do with these universities and museums that take OxyContin money. Or let's say a third generation Sackler heir. A lot of them are filmmakers or restaurateurs. What responsibility do they bear for the opioid epidemic? I think it's a complex question. I'm not sure I know the answer. But what I do know is that the answer to that question is not secrecy. And that's the policy that the Sacklers have jealously maintained for years and years and years.
And from all this, we learn that realities do not come out of nowhere. There's a very specific story here. You can't lay it all at the feet of the Sacklers, but wow, what a role and what a fortune. Christopher Glazik has written it up for Esquire magazine. The Secretive Family, Making Billions from the Opioid Crisis is his headline. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Christopher, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, we will talk with Mike Moore, the big tobacco lawyer who's now gunning for Big Pharma on opioids. This is On Point. I believe that nicotine is not addictive. Remember that? Hard to believe that that was what seven big tobacco execs said under oath before Congress in 1994, but they did not get away with it. And Mike Moore, then the Attorney General of Mississippi, was instrumental in making sure of that. He led the national tobacco litigation effort, resulting in the largest class action settlement in history, $246 billion. Now he's turning his attention to Big Pharma and opioids. And he joins us right now from Tallahassee, Florida. He's a private attorney in private practice now in Mississippi. He's pushing for a class action lawsuit against the pharmaceutical industry for misrepresenting the addiction potential of opioids. Mike Moore, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
You think you're going to get this thing off the ground?
There's no question. It's already off the ground. We represent three states, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Ohio, which is extremely impacted by the opioid epidemic. And there are seven other states who have filed individual lawsuits. So these will be individual lawsuits. They won't be a class action lawsuit. Just like tobacco, each state will bring its own individual case. But it's growing. If you'll remember back, Tom, in tobacco, I filed the first case in 1994, and then it took me almost 2 years before I had five states in the litigation. So this one's moving a little bit quicker, although I would have to tell you this epidemic, you can't move quick enough. The difference between the tobacco issue and this issue is that, you know, you smoke a cigarette today and the disease process starts and may not hit you until 20, 25 years. You take too many of these opioids today and you die. So there's some real immediacy, real emergency to this epidemic, and we as lawyers and the attorneys general of this country are trying to do something about it.
Who do you sue in the opioid case? Who do you go after?
Well, you know, there are a myriad of defendants, Tom. The primary defendants you guys have been talking about all morning, the Sackler family and the Purdue Pharma Company that were the makers of OxyContin and actually are the ones who grew this opioid epidemic. They, started this back in the late 90s. Doctors were real reticent to prescribe opioids because most of those back in those days were you know, morphine sulfate, like that MS Cotton drug that you talked about, and some of the oxy drugs and hydrocodone drugs, and doctors just were reluctant to prescribe those. But Purdue came out with this drug and told everybody there was less than 1% chance of becoming addicted, and they started hiring all these doctors and putting forth all these false studies, and they grew this opioid market so large that not only did Purdue jump in with both feet, it caused all the other opioid makers to jump in. So you sue the manufacturers. You also sue the distributors, the folks who, frankly, deliver the drugs to the various CVSs and Walgreens and that, because they, you know, they'll find a little town in West Virginia that has 800 people, and they'll get an order for 2 million pills, and they actually deliver it rather than stopping it that the law requires, because that's pretty suspicious. It wouldn't take a genius to figure out that there, you know, there's no way to distribute 2 million pills in a little town of 800. And if you drive down there, you'll see, well, there's a pill mill there, and there are people from 10 different states just, you know, in line waiting on buying their prescriptions from a doctor and then going and filling it. So those guys, and then, frankly, some of the drugstore chains made some stupid mistakes along the way. And you know, the Sackler family too, you know, we're looking right now, really hard at some, naming some of those guys personally, in this lawsuit. And if we can come up with enough information, and we actually have some right now that connects them directly to the, you know, misdeeds back in the '90s and early 2000s. So there's a lot of people at fault in this thing, plenty of fault to go around.
What kind of information would make Sackler family members vulnerable to inclusion in this suit or targets?
Well, I read an email last night that I've had for the last 10 or 12 years. I've been looking at this problem since back in 2004 and 2005, and it was an email that one of the doctors there at Purdue sent to all the Sackler family and to the other officials. I mean, even Raymond Sackler and Richard Sackler and Jonathan Sackler and Catherine Sackler, and lots of them were on the email, and it basically talked about how OxyContin didn't have the abuse deterrence that they thought it had, that there were people who were out there abusing it in their trials that they had. They didn't tell that to the FDA, and, you know, the FDA was duped into allowing them to go forward and market that drug. They also have proof that they knew that it didn't last for 12 hours. You know, they kept telling people, look, you can sleep all night with this drug and just take two doses a day, and truth of the matter is it only lasted 6 to 8 hours, and so people were duped that way too. And then the third problem is that there's no real study that ever shows that using opioids for chronic pain over a long period of time actually works. People actually become tolerant to the drug, and it really doesn't decrease the pain. Sometimes it actually increases the pain over a long period of time. So these guys really pulled a fast one, not only on the FDA, but on the American people, and now they're spreading it to all the other countries in the world.
Mike, you had this gigantic success, $246 billion with cigarettes or tobacco. How does this legal challenge around going after the opioid industry compare with the tobacco litigation challenge? How's it like and unlike that?
Well, you started out with how it's like. You know, the tobacco executives denied the three big lies, we call them. They denied that nicotine was an addictive drug. They denied that using the product caused cancer, and they denied that they were actually marketing the drug to children. And then in the opioid epidemic, you know, they denied that it was an addictive drug, when truthfully everybody knows that opium and opium byproducts are addictive, but, or at least they should know. And they told doctors, look, we've got this great new drug, and it's continuous release, and therefore, you know, it delays the absorption, and people won't get addicted. Turns out, you know, big lie, and you had your callers there that, you know, actually got addicted to OxyContin and then went on to heroin. And then basically what they did is they went out and did the craziest thing. They went out and hired the doctors themselves and, you know, educated them to the point that, hey, it's okay to go out and prescribe these things. And matter of fact, we'll give you 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 to be on our speakers bureau, and you can go spread this, you know, this nonsense all across the country. And then they created things like the American Pain Association, the American Pain Foundation, and went on websites and told the users out there, the customers, that, hey, your pain is undertreated. It needs to be treated. If your doc won't prescribe it to you, go to another doctor. So they created this whole market out there. And it's one of those things that, look, there are a lot of people who genuinely have pain who ought to be able to get their prescriptions, and it absolutely takes care of end-of-life-type pain. It takes care of cancer-type pain. But if you get a tooth pulled, you don't need OxyContin. If you have a knee surgery, you don't need OxyContin. I mean, you need a 2 or 3 days of some light opioid, maybe just Tylenol, and then you're okay. Get some physical therapy. But people get hooked on this stuff. The other thing they did, which is crazy, is they came up with this idea, the Sackler family did, that there's this something called pseudo-addiction. People aren't really addicted, you see. They just think that they're addicted, and all you really need to do is to give them more. If they're taking 10 milligrams, give them 20 milligrams or 40 milligrams, and that'll take care of their pain. So, and I guess the last thing they did was they blame all the misuse on abusers. In other words, they're saying that there's no way for anybody to get addicted to this taking it legally. It's only those people who abuse it, who crush it, who snort it. And it turns out that 75 to 80% of the people who get addicted are taking the drug just like a doctor prescribed it. So very similar to the tobacco issue. The one difference I pointed out is there's just really more immediacy to this. There's probably 50 to 60,000 people who will die this year because of it. Tobacco kills 450,000 people a year, much larger companies. Mm-hmm. So these companies don't have the same kind of money that the tobacco industry did, but believe me, they're killing people at a rapid rate. So I'm just trying to get the country focused on it. All the AGs are trying to get the country focused on it. Maybe we can do something about it and stop the dying.
In the case of the Sackler family, Mike, does their very extensive philanthropy help protect or defend them somehow?
Good. You know, Tom, that's a great point. I mean, you know how people are. If a family's out there and they're putting their name on all the big, you know, hospitals and the various wings, the children's hospital and the like, people, there's a lot of goodwill that goes along with that. I think what they've creatively done, though, is they've avoided where the money came from. The story, which your author who just talked about, the Sackler family, wrote a great article in Esquire, and I think there's a great article in the New Yorker right now. Similar. And I tell you, it's a story that needs to be told. You got three brothers who are psychiatrists. They're all doctors of the mind. And they end up creating a drug that gets everybody in the country addicted. I mean, so, the final bell needs to ring on this thing. People need to realize that these folks, at least they're morally liable. Whether all of them are personally liable or not is a question. But in my view, they're morally liable for creating this opioid epidemic. And they absolutely should start doing something about it immediately. You know, instead of putting your name on a hospital or, you know, giving some money to an art museum, why don't you establish a rehabilitation center and a treatment center in every state? And we'll be having those discussions with them soon, I hope.
Mike Moore brought the big lawsuit against the tobacco industry, ended up in the largest class action settlement in history, $246 billion. Now he's looking at the opioid manufacturers, distributors, and more. Joins us today from Tallahassee, Florida. Mr. Moore, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your input today, online and on air. You can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or wherever you get your podcast. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.